Welcome to the ASVAB Domination Podcast, where we help you crush the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, also known as the ASVAB, in order to achieve your dreams of serving in the United States Armed Forces. I'm your host, Mickey Gaminol, and I'm excited to share my years of experience and expertise in ASVAB preparation with you. In each episode, we'll dive deep into test material, strategies for success, and insights from military veterans and experts. Whether you're a high school student considering military service or a seasoned professional seeking to advance your career, this podcast is your ultimate guide to mastering the ASVAB and achieving your goal. Let's dominate the ASVAB together.
Welcome everybody back to the show. Mickey Gaminol with ASVAB Domination today. I am with an outstanding first lieutenant from the Minnesota National Guard, but most impressively, most miraculously, this person has a history similar to mine. He was in Peace Corps for 2 years in the mid-2010s, which is pretty much almost word for word. I think our timelines might be off by a year, but we were in Peace Corps right around the same time, different countries, and then we joined the Army National Guard in our respective states right around the same time. And now we're both XOs, so go figure that one. But without any further ado, Sean Lundy, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, guys. Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me to talk. I was telling him before we started recording here that, I've met a couple people that had done the Peace Corps and served in the Army, but no one that had almost identical timelines, and also National Guard specifically after doing the Peace Corps. You do find a lot of people that serve in the Army first and then do the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. but it's very rarely you see people go from the Peace Corps to the Army. So yeah, no, I'm glad that you reached out, and I'm happy to be here.
Hell yeah. Yeah, thank you. I know that I reached out just on the fly from, the ether of the internet. So thanks for taking the time to, just be on the show and stuff like that. I really appreciate it. But yeah, before we get started, let me just ask you, tell me about your Peace Corps experience, or not Peace Corps experience. Woo! Tell me about your ASVAB experience. How did you study? What'd you score? Did you feel like you did well? That kind of thing.
Yeah, just as a quick side note too, man, like government service, someday I'm going to write a book about that because I keep mixing up, Peace Corps, Yeah, so I guess you'll give me a chance to kind of talk about my life story in general, but to kind of talk specifically to the ASVAB thing, it relates to my life story in the sense that when I was in high school, my plan was to join the Army. I was a pretty good student. Nearly a 4.0. I played sports and did honor society and stuff like that. I could have applied to any school that I wanted to and, got in, but you're 16 or 17 at the time. I was like, I'm going to join the Army. I'm not even going to think about college. I played football. Guys on my football team were enlisting. That's just what I thought my plan was going to be. That was back in 2006, 7, 8. There was a troop surge in Afghanistan and Iraq. A lot of guys that I knew, not from my football team per se, but just in general, were going over there, and some of them were coming back with injuries. And my mom was aware of that, and she was like, fuck that, you're going to go to college. the good son that I am, I went. But so the ASVAB, in high school, I knew that was kind of the first hurdle you had to get through to get into the Army. So I had started looking into it, obviously didn't take it at that time. But I had, by the time I was going through the process of enlisting, I had been through undergrad. I had been through Peace Corps. I went to DC and worked a couple, high velocity jobs there. So when it came to the ASVAB, I was like, I'm going to study, man. I'm going to break out the test books. I'm going to hit up everybody I know that served and try to get pointers. And there should have been a clue to me at the time, but when I was asking a lot of my buddies who had served for tips on scoring well in the ASVAB, they were like, the ASVAB. Oh, man. I don't even remember taking that. I mean, I think that's what you got to do to get through MEPS, right? And I'm like, yeah, you don't remember the ASVAB? And they're like, I don't know, man, just read books and you'll be fine. You're like 26, like everybody else in there is 17. Like, don't worry about it. But no, I stressed over it. So I definitely did a lot of studying, and I walked in there, and I was also studying for the GMAT at the same time because I want to go to grad school. And the GMAT was, man, that's a totally different beast.
That's a doozy.
I approached the ASVAB with the same mindset. I would take some practice exams and I would, take the curriculum seriously. Being older, though, I didn't have many issues with it. A lot of it is just kind of logic, you know? So, like, if this happens, what's a natural outcome of that? You know, if you crank a wrench in this direction,
Right.
all the wheels and the spokes, how which ways do they turn? You know, if you're traveling at this velocity, how fast can you go from point A to point B? So I thought that there were going to be some gotcha questions or, you know, hidden twists and turns, but it was pretty straightforward. And I ended up getting, I mean, I think the overall, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're an expert on this, but the overall it's out of like 140,
Right. Yeah.
right? And then you,
Your general technical is your GT score. That's going to be out of 140. And then your AFQT, which is your qualifying score, that's going to be 0 to 99. But that's norming, right? That's just going to be based on the bell curve of where you fall with averages. So your GT score.
So my GT score was 135,
Oh,
and
shit.
then yeah, that the 0 to 99, I got a 97 on that one.
Nice.
Yeah, and I was interested. Part of my angle after, especially after serving the Peace Corps, was I wanted to go into intelligence. I wanted to be an MI officer. You know, you always 2020 hindsight is always pretty clear, right? So looking back, I probably should have looked at the officer slots that the Minnesota Guard had available the year that I was enlisting, because there weren't any MI slots. I didn't even think to look. So I got these scores that opened up all the doors that I could have taken in the US Army. And then when it came time to branch, I had the scores I needed to be an MI officer. There just wasn't a
There wasn't a
slot.
slot. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is too bad. You know, if I was serious about intelligence work, I probably should have, you know, joined the Navy reserves or something.
This on a state level, I don't know how key the military intelligence comes up for any National Guard one.
I think there was like three slots in a good year, you know.
Yeah, that makes
But
sense.
I'm very happy with how my Army career has played out, though, so no regrets.
Heck yeah. Cool. No, I mean a 97's killer. I scored a 97 when I took it. I was 25. I'd finished Peace Corps just like you. I had my bachelor's. I had some No, I didn't have any high level jobs at that point, but yeah, pretty much the same story, but I taught math, so I kind of had that inside edge. I'm used to like seeing those types of the specifically the math questions that you see on there. But with your career, you'd probably seen you'd used practical applications for, averages and what is the most likely outcome based on the previous numbers. So you knew how to apply that into the workforce. I'm sure that gave you the edge to get that 97 on the score.
Yeah, I mean, like one of the things I always tell people about my story when it comes to the Army is that I wish I had enlisted earlier from like a physicality standpoint. You know, like the older you get, the more the body hurts when you do stuff. Like I'm wearing this sweatshirt specifically because I just returned from Scout Leader Course down at Fort Benning,
Hell yeah.
which is a punishing course. I was, you know, 10 years older than most of the other students there. So it hurt more in the morning when he got up. So being 24 instead of 34 or 33, however old I am, you know, that would have helped me out a lot. But on the other side of that, the life experience that I've had, I think, has made navigating a lot of the decision points you run into as an officer far easier, because you have the life experience, you have the reference points, you've been in those soldiers' shoes, and you just have a bigger head start and kind of game planning and war gaming how to like help and fix and manage situations. And that's true with the ASVAB too, right? Like I said, I want to go to grad school, so I was in the studying mindset. You know, I would get up every morning and put in 45 hours of studying or 45 minutes of studying, and I took the ASVAB seriously. So
Cool. Yeah, and that's, I mean, good for you. I think a lot of people, you're exactly right. Most people are just gonna think of it as getting their teeth checked. The majority of, unless you fail, there's no real reason that people see to study it. But a lot of the people I interview, they've studied, they feel maybe some of them feel like they overkilled for it, but it's not like you're gonna have a ton of regret on, studying basic formulas and stuff like that. It's not gonna like be like, oh, what a waste of time. So
no, and one of my best friends from the Peace Corps, he actually was recently, I don't know the right terminology for this, but he was accepted as a foreign service officer with the State Department. So he's right now training to go get sent
FSO.
to his, As an FSO, he's being sent to his first posting. And I mean, who knows if this is real, but the word on the street is that the Foreign Service exam is the hardest exam the U.S. government administers. And my buddy, he tested really well in it. And I've always, thought, I just want to try it someday, right? Let's just see what I can get. And so I was asking him like how he prepared for it. And I think this is good advice for any standardized test that the U.S. government has, really. So he said, I didn't study for it, but I did read the news every single day from a wide variety of sources. It's not just for reading comprehension, it's like reading about problems in the world and thinking through how I might approach that and solve that particular problem. And because he was keeping a global perspective, he was consuming stuff about geopolitics regionally, all the way down to like the machinery that goes into a sewer system in a given urban environment and how you might need to like troubleshoot that from an engineering perspective. And he's like, just be interested, just find things interesting and think about how they work. And that's true with the ASVAB,
No, I think you're exactly right. The critical thinking aspect of it, and like figuring out why people do this or why the right way to do it is that way, I think that is going to carry you a long way. I think that's going to get you into the high 80s, just with that kind of mindset. If you want to get up into the 90, and it's just bragging rights, right? The 135, that's overkill. You only needed a 115 to open all the doors that you wanted. But there's something about scoring really, really well on a test that just makes you confident in everything you do. And that's worth something.
Well, and this is just a funny side note, but at SLC we had to submit paperwork that included our ASVAB scores, and like some of the cadre, when they were trying to just fuck with us, they would pull out those documents and read off people's GT scores just to mainly to find bad scores and make fun of people. But they found mine, and they're like, oh, God, a fucking scholar here, and actually, I was submitted. There was a lot of, scholar jokes, Professor Lundy, so.
Fuck yeah. Well, I mean, and it's better to have that kind of reputation all day long. So why the fuck
Well,
not?
then
The
obviously they gave me all the, PL
real work.
slots during validation. So then I doing a job I didn't understand how to do yet, and I was being graded on it.
Yep.
It's just like, oh, great. I wish I got like an 85 on my GT, but whatever.
Yeah, well, that's what cadre does, right? They like figure out if they can find anything that they can pick on, and they just start
Yeah,
chiseling away.
it's a good time.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Okay, so I know you kind of glazed over it, but it sounds like you got kind of like a preloaded life story. I know Peace Corps and National Guard are huge moves that 99% of the world is never going to take. So there's got to be something in it, right? It's not easy to just make those two organizations and those two careers happen in your lifetime. It hasn't been for me, at least not in my experience. So,
Yeah.
what is your what's your story? How'd you get to that trajectory?
I mean, that's a really good question. So I grew up in both my parents, they work for state government in Minnesota. So public service, it wasn't always, framed as public service per se, but this idea that you are working in institutions that have a social bottom line built into it, working towards a mission that's, kind of bigger than any one person or bank statement or whatever else. I wouldn't say that, like, I've only recently, upon reflecting on my life, have came to view that as like an influence. But I think at the time when I was younger, both my parents are well traveled. They spent their younger years traveling the world. They had stories. They told those stories at the dinner table. So I grew up assuming I would do the same, or at least aspiring to have a similar life story. Sorry, I'm just
No stress, no
exiting out
stress.
the things that are making noise on my computer. So when I was in high school, I signed up for summer experiences, whether it was through our church or through, youth organizations, where I got to, go to the U.S.-Mexican border and set up aid stations for people crossing the border. We also went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina to help dig out homes in the Ninth Ward, try to find, recover bodies and try to rebuild homes and stuff like that, like immediately after the hurricane. And so by the time I was a senior in high school, I knew the world was big, and I knew that I had only seen a small sliver of it.
Oh,
And
yeah.
I wanted to go, I was impatient. I wanted to go do something. So, my 16, 17-year-old brain was like, I think the US Army is the best way to do that. My father didn't serve, but my grandfather served and an uncle served. And, I heard their stories and I wanted to go do that. When, my mother stepped in and doing the right thing as a mother convinced me not to do that and go to college, I pivoted and I was like, okay, well, if I have, if this is, the path or the door that's opening for me, how can I find an adventure through doing this? And I only applied to one school, and that was Iowa State University. And I applied there specifically because they were launching a Peace Corps preparatory program in 2009
Shoo, that's cool.
in the fall, and that was going to be my freshman year, and I wanted to be a part of that. I didn't really.
I'm the exact same. I went to
Oh, really?
college thinking I'm gonna go to Peace Corps, and that was. I mean, I went to UNLV. I was born in Salt Lake City, but I went to Vegas, thinking, okay, I'm gonna go to college just to go to Peace Corps, and so it's awesome, right? I loved going to school knowing that that was the end goal because.
Yeah.
You're never so sure of yourself as you are when you're an 18-year-old future Peace Corps-y because it's like, let's go. Like, what your life, you think you have it all figured out at that age, like
Totally.
100%.
Well, and like, what? Yeah, I spent a lot of time. I don't know if this is true with you, but I routinely get contacted on LinkedIn by currently serving Peace Corps volunteers who are in their second year service, and they just want to reach out and talk to people back in the United States that are in the job market and just like, hey man, like I'm trying to figure out what my next step is. Like, do you mind if I just pick your brain? And these are people I don't know. I like they're cold calling me. I did the same thing in Peace Corps. And so like it's people would connect with me and
Oh
they
yeah.
did that favor to me. So a personal policy of mine is that when I get contacted by a currently serving Peace Corps volunteer, I always take the call and I always meet with them. And some of the advice to get to the point, some of the advice that I give them is you can't plan out your life to a degree where there's no margin for error. Like the reason, like looking at my life map, you could say, wow, this guy, he made a plan and he built slowly over time to make it happen. And that is just not, that's just not the case. I think the best way to describe it is I would push on a door, and if the door didn't open, I would pivot to the next door. And if it was open, I would push that motherfucker open. And I just say that, like, I'm just the guy who's like not scared to pull the trigger and take a risk, And LinkedIn does not have the failures
No.
that exist. And there
Oh.
were a lot of them. The successes are only a small portion of the different effort, different initiatives I put out there into the world. But just like dating on the apps, it's a numbers game. And unless you're taking chances and taking risks on a regular basis, you're not creating opportunities for success.
True that. No, I love that. And it's funny that you say that because I looked at your LinkedIn and thought to myself, wow, this guy has it all figured out. And then I thought about it. I'm like, I have a very similar path. And I didn't like none of this was scripted. None of this was like A to B to C to D. This is like different alphabets. There's kanji in there, there's Arabic, there's all sorts of madness of just like jumping all over the world, all over the map, as far as a life plan. So it is funny that you mentioned that Peace Corps people will reach out to you. I mean, I don't get a ton of Peace Corps traction. I don't put it out as much that I am an RPCV, even though I got a lot of pride. Like I said, I went to school just to go to Peace Corps. But yeah, I think it's so funny that up until that Peace Corps point, you kind of feel like you're in control. You feel like you're in the driver's seat. And if Peace Corps is not an awake, if the Peace Corps doesn't make you realize you're not really in control, nothing is going to make you realize that you're not really in control.
Absolutely. There are so many similarities like across the life experiences, right? Like I think the reason that I've been able to be quote unquote successful in life is because of what Peace Corps has taught me, which is like you need to have patience, you need to be flexible, and you need to be okay just like absorbing failure after failure after failure and still getting up every morning and saying like, okay, that didn't work. What can I try now? You know, because when you're in a resource restrictive environment in a culture that doesn't speak your native language and you look different than everybody and you stand out, like you're only gonna flail. And you just have to be okay looking like a dork and still moving forward and trying to find ways to move the ball forward, you know, every single day. And so I think that mentality has done a lot in terms of resilience overall. And I was gonna say too, like, although I didn't map anything out for myself, I've realized over time that I'm somebody who very much does need to have like a mission. The times in my life when I've struggled professionally or personally or whatever it is, it's times when I look back and think about it, I didn't have like a purpose laid out for myself. And it doesn't need to be like, I'm going to go to the best grad school and get the best grades. It's more just like, I need to be building towards something. Even if it's something that's years away, there needs to be something that I'm working towards. Because if not, if that purpose doesn't exist, I flounder. So I've just done a good job of like finding, like figuring out what matters to me, finding that purpose, and then finding a vehicle that kind of like will help me realize that purpose, and then getting in that vehicle and
Gunning
just gunning it. Yeah.
it,
You know,
figuring
firing, you
out which
know.
one's the gas and which one's the brakes. That's kind
Yeah.
of that can be tough, but
And going for a ride until it crashes, and then you get out and you're like, all right, that didn't work. What am I? Let's find another one.
right. I love it. I mean, it's so true. It's so true. So much of my, you know, once I got back from Peace Corps, I don't know if you had the similar experience, but getting back from Peace Corps, I'd never been so unsure of what to do next in all of my life, you know, because I was like, I don't know where I'm going or what I'm doing at that point. So you just kind of have to, you either, you don't really, I think I'm like you in that I can't make it up as I go along. It has to be somewhere out there. It can't be something I already have. It has to be something I'm going towards. So yeah, great advice. Great advice.
Oh, and I was gonna say too, when I took a little look at your LinkedIn too, I was like, yeah, this guy seems like he has it figured out. But I bet $1 million, considering our stories are the same, I bet $1 million that this guy has done a lot of the same pivot that didn't work. All right, go this way. All right, backtrack, restart, you know, like
1,000%, 1,000%. Yeah, I would say 90, like post Peace Corps, 90% of my life has felt like I don't know where I'm going, which is hilarious because you look at LinkedIn and it's all very clear. Oh, this person, bop, 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 bop. But
Well, and
yeah.
it's just like I think back to, well, I was gonna say too that another thing that I did a really good job of in life is I cultivating mentors. You know, finding people that are doing interesting shit that I wanna do, and then just like finding ways to talk to them and just pick their brain. Hey, and sometimes maybe it like they end up, you know, becoming a great resource or even an entry point into an industry or a job or whatever it is. But at a bare minimum, at least cultivating a relationship where like they share their lessons learned to you, and you therefore have, you know, those additional, yeah, lessons learned to use and build upon yourself, you know. And I think that is something that I would highly recommend to people, you know, in younger generations, is just like find people that are doing cool shit and just reach out to them, you know. Like people, like I was saying with Peace Corps volunteers that reach out to me, like people want to feel like what they've done has mattered and that people want to learn from them, you know. People will talk about themselves.
No, 100%. I think you're exactly right. It's funny, like the world is so small because I'm sure while you were in, it was Tioga, right?
Togo, yeah.
Togo. While you're in Togo, I'm sure, you know, so many people were asking you because you're kind of like a C-lister. It was the same in Morocco. You know, I'm the 6 foot white guy. You know, I'm not hiding anywhere. They're gonna see me. So like, I'm sure you
Own
had, yeah.
It's like I'm not gonna be local. There's no way I can pass for that.
Yep, exactly. They're gonna see the Americans always. And it's cool. You get a lot of people asking, like you see kind of the reverse of like a lot of people saying, hey, what about this? What about that? What do you think of President Bush or the other ones, right? Like they're asking all sorts of stuff. What's it like in Minnesota? Or they probably walk up to you and ask you, like, what's it like in New York? Like they would ask me that stuff, even though I was from Vegas. And like it was a completely different thing. When you get back to the States, people are afraid to reach out for mentors. You know, they're like, they would never, God forbid, walk up on the street. Thank God there's LinkedIn where you can just like hide behind a keyboard and reach out. But yeah, I think Peace Corps really emboldens you to just ask, you know, if you want to find something out, just reach out to these people. And it's great that you pay it forward like that.
Well, it's like the metaphor is like, you're a tourist and like my girlfriend's in the other room right now, so I don't want to speak too loudly, but we travel a lot and whenever we go to a new place and we don't know how to find the restaurant or where the museum is, I pull out a map, man. I don't feel bad about being and then just like flagging a random person down and being like, hey, do you know how to find this one? But and she's just like, oh my God, so embarrassing. Like, and I'm like, this is how you get to know the local culture and the people is you gotta look like an idiot. You just gotta walk into that cafe and be like, hey, do you speak English? No? Well, fuck me. I'm just using my broken French or broken Spanish or whatever. And well, I'm going to use my hands and I'm going to ask you how to find the
Yep.
bathroom.
100%. Well, and like that's what it does. Peace, like whether you like it or not, Peace Corps will, it humbles you because when you get there, you have the language capacity of a 1-year-old. Like you have zero language and you work up to about a 7th grade proficiency and then you're on your own. At least that was my experience in Morocco. They sent us to our own little communities and you're basically there with maybe one other American. Maybe the closest American is an hour or two away and you're just figuring it out from that point forward. So you're gonna look foolish, like probably daily for a few months.
No, and I remember getting dropped off in my village when it was time to go there, and like it was a 14-hour bush taxi ride to the end of the world. And I remember like we pulled up to the side of my village, and the guy was like, "All right, this is you get out." And I was like, "This is where I'm living for 2 years? Are you kidding me?" And I get out, and I show up there, and all these people are like, "Oh, the doctor's here, the doctor's here," and I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa." I'm a community health volunteer. I mean, at best, I can talk about washing hands and like, I don't know, like food preparation. They're like, no, you're a doctor. And I'm like, I can't cook food. I can't speak the language. I think I have allergies. I'm having a terrible time just breathing here. No, what? I'm a newborn, dude. You need to hold my hand until I know how to walk.
I think it was my second day on site that I sat in a cafe and somebody was talking to me about their kidneys. And then I realized this person thinks I'm somebody I'm definitely not. Like, I don't know anything about kidneys. Oh.
Yeah, no, I like my counterpart, they like match you up with in Togo, they call them homologues, that's like a French term for like community partner or whatever. And my homologue like brought me to the clinic like one of the first days I was there, and we sat down, and I realized pretty quickly like people were lining up to see me, and I was like, okay, I guess they're trying to meet me. And he was like, oh no, these women are all pregnant, like they need their prenatal checkups or whatever. And I was like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to explain this to you in un no uncertain terms that I am not qualified. The first rule of medicine is do no harm. And I actively will hurt people if you have me do anything right now, because I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah, it's funny.
Well, and even the easy stuff, like you're making up the easy stuff as you go along too, you know, like the stuff that you actually can do, you can't do it well for the first 6 months anyway, you know, so.
Yeah, and when you get to village, Peace Corps is like, hey, spend the first 12 months integrating and then start doing projects. And as an American who's like used to pumping out projects in a week or two, you're like, 12 months? You want me to sit around and integrate for 12 months? And then you get to village and you're like, yeah, this is going to take 12 months. Like, I got to earn the trust. I got to trust myself first here. I got to figure out how to survive, build relationships, and then like actually understand, there's the surface level culture that you experience. And then there's just all the layers and depth of like interpersonal conflicts and inner family conflicts and politics. And like you start peeling back the layers and you realize like, okay, these are the power dynamics that exist here. And now I know who to go to for this thing and this other person for that thing. And like now I can be effective. But it took 12 months.
Easy, easy 12 months for sure. Well, cool. So that's pretty cool. I mean, I think, Peace Corps, like we said, kind of preps you up for anything where you don't know what you're doing. And I think that, I mean, that helped me in basic training. Did you feel that you leaned on your Peace Corps experience through basic training, OCS, that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah. I had a Peace Corps serving in Togo, and I can only speak to Togo. It was punishing. 90% of my time there was spent just trying to survive. It's a country that hasn't seen any meaningful economic development in 100 years. And so like a lot of life there was just troubleshooting basic survival, but also psychologically kind of reinforcing yourself for the day-to-day grind, and just like re setting expectations for yourself, realistic expectations, like kind of working backwards and figuring out like, all right, so this is a totally different social structure. Like this is what I have to do first in order to get here. So when I showed up in basic training, I realized pretty quickly, like I ended up going in June when all of these split option basic trainings were going. So these were, I mean, it was 60% 17-year-olds that were in between their junior and senior year of high school.
Whoa.
And the difference in life experience was readily apparent right away, where like you'd be getting yelled at by the drill sergeants, but I knew it was a game. And I knew that pain is temporary, so it's like, hey man, if I just gotta sit here in the front leaning rest position until they say stop, like that's cool. Like my world, the meaning of my life is just sitting in the push-up position, and I'm not gonna get worked up about it. I'm not gonna think about everything that goes into and the 17-year-old next to me was like, oh, the drill sergeants hate me, and I'd just be like, hey man, this is just a game. They don't hate you. Like this, that's not what's going on here. It's just a game, So like it very much put things in perspective where it's like, this is temporary. I can do anything in the world as long as there's an end date or an end time to it, So
Did you feel the same thing at SLC, the Scouts Leadership Course? Is it
Yeah,
transferable?
very much. I mean, that is definitely the hardest Army course I've been to. It was only 4 weeks, but it was, the first phase of that was all classroom time doing op boards, and it's, reconnaissance to security operations. So they're relatively complex, platoon level operations that include mechanized, armored, Bradley armored fighting vehicles, dismounts, setting up OPs, being in undefined terrain, no man's land behind enemy lines. You're trying to get eyes on enemy or gain an observation of enemy positions before they see you. You have aerial assets that you can request that are above you, coordinating fire missions. And then the second phase of SLC was going into the field, not sleeping for a
Two weeks.
week at a time, multiple different stints in the field and putting all of that into practice. So it was like SLC tested the mind, body, soul. It was all encompassing. So, like some army schools you go to, it's like all physical, and you're just like, all right, I'll just go to my happy place in my head and I'll just run until they tell me to stop. And some army schools are like, it's all classroom time. So it's like, all right, I don't have to worry about the physical side. I just have to stay locked in and just do exactly, just learn exactly what they tell me and spit that out and keep doing it. SLC was like, you got to do the mental calculations at the same time that you are carrying 150 pounds of gear, trying to maneuver through the terrain and not be seen by drones. So yeah, it was.
Wow, that's wild. But I mean, you had to have had that countdown in your mind, right? You had to have been thinking, okay, one more week, let's go.
Totally. Yeah. And it's like
That's
that mindset that I think. So this actually is, this is something that I've reminisced on a little bit. When I was in the Peace Corps, I got malaria at one point, and I was really sick, and I was sitting in this tech house, and the only book, there weren't TVs, weren't cell phones to watch stuff on. Like, I was just sitting there staring at the ceiling, watching this fan
Oof.
slowly spin, you know, and it was just like days and days of that. And there was one book, and it was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning.
Hell yeah.
Now, for those that don't know who Viktor Frankl is, he's a well-known philosopher who's a Holocaust survivor. So I was like, well, I was sitting there with malaria. I was like, the last thing I want to do is read a book about the Holocaust because I think I'm dying myself. Like, this is wild. But I eventually picked the book up and read it, and it blew my mind. There's a section in the book where he talks about the meaning of life, hence the title, and he says that there is no greater meaning of life. In the book, he had just found out that his wife, all of his kids, and his parents had perished in the concentration camps. So he was still alive. He was on a work or whatever, and he was digging a trench on the side of the road, and this bird flew by and landed on the pile of dirt that he was digging out of the hole. And he hadn't seen a bird in years because they'd all been killed off. But he saw this bird land, and then it flew away, and he realized that, like, the meaning of life is not like the number 47 or like love or whatever the abstract concepts are you hear about relatively. It's this meaning, like the meaning of my life right now is this conversation. And in the next moment, it might be cooking a really good meal that's healthy. And in the moment after that, it's the conversation I'm having with my friend about the movie we just saw. And the meaning of life is just moment to moment to moment. And if you focus on that reality, you can get through anything.
Yeah,
You
I
know, and
like it.
that's the mentality that got me through Peace Corps. That's the mentality that got me through the Army, which is like, hey, I just find the meaning of this moment right now. And I.
After that shit got you through malaria, you were like, all right, I guess I'll just lock in on a moment-to-moment basis.
And to put it in perspective too, because I was in there and I was like, all right, my life isn't that bad. You know,
Dang. Yeah.
just
That's the part I remember from that book. The part I remember
you're right too.
after
Yeah,
reading that is like, okay, at least I'm not there. You know, like it was gnarly, you know, but I remember because a lot of his cohort was going through the same thing where they find out they're the sole survivor. And most of them drop like flies after that because without their people, you know, that they were without the reasons that they were living for, they decided to wrap it up. But I didn't remember the solution that you just shared. I completely forgot. Like the whole point is to just live in that moment. That's cool. That's very profound.
You know, another part of that book that might undercut some of what we're saying, though, is that the people who would perish, he said, were the people that had in their mind, like, hey, the Allies are going to liberate our camp on March 15th. And they would just, like, I just got to make it to March 15th. And they would choose those dates, whether it was like there was rumors in the camp, or someone heard a clip from BBC, or they just came up with the date on their own. And then March 15th would show up and pass, and they would lose the will to keep fighting on because they had set that time hack for themselves. And if they can just make it to that, they can survive this. And then they would come and go, and they would just be like, where Viktor Frankl was saying, he's like, you just every day, you just get up and you just have to just get through that day.
Yeah.
And then you go to bed and you get up in the morning and you just. Or what I would tell myself in basic training was, I was like, I just got to survive to breakfast.
Yep. Chow to
Make the
chow.
breakfast. Yep. And then I just got to
Chow
survive to lunch,
to
you know? And then I just got to survive dinner, you know? And you're just on that treadmill. You're just trying to survive to the next meal. You're not trying to create this, like, okay, I got one more week in me. It's like, no. Can't
No.
have that in your head.
Yeah. You're exactly right. Yeah, that's where people make the mistake. I would imagine, I'm sure on deployments too, you know, people go and they're like, okay, well, this is just 1 year. It's just 1 year. It's like, there's no just to 1 year. You know, like you gotta just get through the next hour, 2 hours or whatever. You gotta eat an elephant one bite at a time because even just 6 months or just 1 month, it's a lot. So one at a
Yeah.
time.
Well, and it helps it, you know, I just so that this past weekend I did the Norwegian Ruck March.
Yeah, I
So
saw that post. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's 18.6 miles in 4.5 hours carrying 25 pounds. Like, I'd never done a rock that long in my life. I'd done the 12 miles that you do at these trainings. Basically, to do it in 4.5 hours, you have to keep a 15-minute pace steady. And I had no idea if I could do that. But I did know the one competitive advantage I had was this mentality, this mindset where it's like, I don't have to think about getting to 18.6 miles. I just got to think about getting one foot in front of the other.
Hell yeah.
You know, that's all I focused on. And I ended up finishing the ruck in less than 4 hours. I actually, my ruck got weighed afterwards and I didn't even know, but it was 35 pounds, not 25, because I'm an idiot and I packed all my gear.
Extra socks. You got to bring those
Yeah.
extra socks.
Well, extra boots. Yeah, I did. And I had way too much water. But yeah, I finished it and I was like, holy crap, I did not think I could do this. But I knew immediately that the reason I got through it and performed relatively well was because I didn't think about
Everything.
the, yeah, the whole picture. I broke it down into very manageable chunks, which was like, all right, I see a bend in the trail up there. I just got to make it to that bend. And then I get around the bend and it's like, okay, the next bend is a half mile away. I'm just going to focus on that bend, you know, just there and so on and so on and so on.
Hell yeah. Nice. No, that's great. That's great. So military career wise, your XO right now, are you gonna be pinning 03? I know that you said it took a year and a half, so you probably got, you got your rank. I know when I got my 1LT, I got some back pay because it was behind. So that was nice, but it does mean you're that much closer to 03, right? You're that much closer to your rank up next. So what's it look like for your on your side of the fence over there in Minnesota?
Yeah, it's coming up pretty soon here. I should be getting a little bit more clarity on how this is all gonna kind of play out. I don't know how it is in your unit, but in my unit, they have this like officer leaderboard, so they rank all
Oh,
the
there's like an
officers.
OML across the state.
Kind of. Well, it's for the squadron, so
Okay.
like the regiment, and so like all the captains and majors, and then the squadron commander like sit down once a year, and they kind of they talk about all the officers. They pull out, you know, like this person has these schools, these qualifications. This is what their OER looks like. This is the general consensus among people about their personality and drive and whatever else. And the higher up you get in the organization, there's fewer slots. So, you know, in terms of getting captain and then actually getting a command slot, I mean, most officers that make it to captain don't get a command slot. They get bounced out to do a broadening assignment with a different unit, or they get put on staff, squadron staff, or whatever it is. So I'm not really sure what the next step is going to look like, but I'm, you know, planning around hopefully getting a troop command here, you know, and getting command time next.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know for sure. I'm just working towards that.
Right. Yeah, no, that's the dream. That's the dream. We had a change. I was thinking that I was going to get command time, and then I got bumped to staff, and so I was pretty bummed. You still pin 03, which I guess is nifty, but yeah, that command time, man, like that, I cannot wait. It's like watching a football game and you're like, they just throw it to the guy that's open, and like you want to be there. And especially as an XO, you're the one who's making, whatever you have to fulfill the commander's intent. And, whether you like it or not, nobody's 100% the same, and nobody's 100% right, even if we were all the same. So it's definitely a draw. I can see the, I hope you get command time. I'd imagine you get some chest candy with SLC, so I'd imagine that should bump you up, right?
You actually don't get chest candy, which is really annoying, but it's an ASI, so you know you have that like additional skill identifier on your profile. You know, in the scout world, the world of Cav Scouts, like not a lot of what we go through gets to be worn on the uniform, which is too bad.
That's
You
a
know, like we
shame.
have our spur ride, which is like our expert infantry badge. You know how like the infantry get to wear that on their uniform. Well, like our version of that is the spur ride, but you don't get to, and there's no like,
There's no patch.
there's no patch, there's no ribbon, there's no candy, there's no bling. You just get to wear spurs when you dress up in your ASUs. That's it.
Oh, shoot.
So wait, you're XO right now. So
Yep.
are you
Yeah,
have your next step? for now?
Yeah, I'm probably looking at battalion staff. National Guard's weird, and it's so cool to talk to a fellow Peace Corps person because Peace Corps is weird. Obviously, I
Nice.
mean, Peace Corps, nothing, ain't nothing weirder than Peace Corps. But one of the weird things that I carry over to National Guard is that time dilation, where you could be in the National Guard for 6 years, but you've only worked, what, 8 weeks, something like that. And so,
Yeah.
like, it doesn't make any sense when you, like, see these people every month for 2 days, and that just adds to your IPERMs. Whereas Peace Corps is the reverse, right? You could be in that, like you were talking about, you're there for 12 months and you're finally figuring out how to put your shoes on the right way after those 12 months. So, yeah, I think it's one of those things, but yeah, my next step, all likelihood, is going to be battalion staff, like S2, S3, something like that. So I'll take, or maybe like assistant, one of those spots. So I'm all for it. Our
Which
BC is
is
pretty
good
good.
experience,
Yeah.
like it is seeing it from
But
that the staff side, so that when you do become a commander, you do have that perspective and you know what resources to ask for.
yeah, it will make me a better commander, but that is not what I'm hung. I'm not hungry to be a good commander. I'm hungry to be a commander right now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I get that. I get that for sure.
But no, that's great. And I think I mean all the best. I think honestly, you get it. Whenever you work with somebody else who's been through Peace Corps, there's a certain amount of like humanity there where like this person should get all the promotions. It's like what I come away thinking, like, this person has been through enough to know how to empathize with all of their troops. Like there's no question, there's not gonna be leaving people out. Even the soldiers that suck, you're gonna know how to bring them in because you've worked with people who were didn't want to work with you and had no reason to work with you. You've had to, sit there and beg the director of the youth center to, open the doors by bringing them cookies or like whatever ridiculous thing. You've done so much by that point that there's nothing in your command that's gonna like surprise you. Like, oh crap, what could I possibly do here? You'll have some sort of a solution. And even more importantly, you'll know who to ask because you were in Peace Corps and there was nothing that you learned more than who is my ally in this strange place. So.
That's totally true. And what I would say too about Peace Corps, which feeds into the army, which is I haven't figured out yet what's the right answer. If people that do the Peace Corps are attracted to it because they have a high emotional intelligence, or the people that end up making it through the full Peace Corps service and are quote unquote successful, they're successful and they make it through because they have a higher emotional intelligence. But either way, if you come out the other side of the experience being in the Peace Corps, you have to have a high emotional intelligence, whether that's inherent or whether that's learned. You can't make it through that experience without learning to read people and read social dynamics and understand how to connect to people, right? Like I've always said that, like I made friends with the village chief. I lived in a Sunni Muslim village. This man, the colonial language there was French. He didn't even speak French. He spoke this local dialect that's spoken by 40,000 people in the entire world. That's it. So I couldn't even communicate with him. But if I can make friends with this man, who's 60 years old, has never left this small village in his entire life. He has seven wives and he lives in this incredibly conservative social culture. Like if I can find common ground with him and like legitimately enjoy sitting under the mango tree with him and like herding his goats with him, I can make friends with anybody in the world.
Right. And the funniest part, your fellow LTs are going to be like, oh, that colonel, oh, that colonel's a lot. And you're like, dude, like go to some place where for generations they've been handing down the couscous recipe and accidentally say that it tastes bad. And then you figure out what an awkward social situation
Yes.
is.
You don't know what it means to be an outcast until you've insulted
Right.
the crown jewel of the local cuisine.
Yeah, and you got to go through and repair that relationship. Absolutely, because you rely on your host family or whatever. Like that is your lifeblood. And so yeah, there's no di more dire straits, I think, than I mean, I haven't been on any deployments or anything like that. I'm sure there's harder times in the military, obviously. But the majority of this, like getting along professionally and office politics and that kind of stuff, nothing compared to Peace Corps, at least in my experiences, that you're just so well prepared.
Absolutely. The first platoon sergeant I had, like again, just like Peace Corps, when you show up in village, you're just a newborn, you don't know what you're doing. You commission as a second lieutenant and you get placed as a platoon leader with your first unit. You have rank, you have authority, you have responsibility, but you don't know anything, And I went to OCS and Bolick, well, mainly Bolick with a bunch of ROTC cats, and nothing against ROTC, but none of them had joined a unit yet or taken over as platoon leader. And I just remember hearing some of them talk about how they're gonna like kick in the door and like just like lay down the law. And I remember just being like, that just sounds like the wrong approach. Like I remember making notes in my head being like, I'm not gonna do that. And so when I showed up and I took over as platoon leader, my first unit, I told my PSG just straight up in the first conversation I had with him. I was like, I don't know anything. You're the content expert. I have the rank and I have the authority, but you're the one that actually has the answers. I'm here to learn from you. Like you have a lot of influence over me right now because I'm going to assume that you've been doing this long enough that you know the right answers. I'm going to sign off on a lot of stuff based on your recommendation, and I'm going to be building my long-term institutional knowledge based on what I pick up from you. And that's going to help me swim or sink me, depending on the quality of that information. And he gave me this look, and he was known across the whole squadron as like, this guy has his shit together. He is a go-getter. He makes shit happen. But as a result of that, he just runs over junior officers. Like if you're in his way and you're slowing him down, he will just bulldoze you. He gave me this look where he was like, sir, I don't usually like to give second lieutenants the time of day because you're typically just like in my way. But he's like, I respect that. Like, thank you for saying that. No, I haven't had a second lieutenant ever come in and say that right off the bat. And we ended up having a phenomenal working relationship as a result of that. I learned everything that has made me a good officer, I learned from that guy. And as a result, he got to run the platoon the way he wanted to, and it ended up becoming one of the highest performing platoons in the squadron as a result of that. Like, I got out of his way, you know? And the feedback I received from all my soldiers after I left as a platoon leader from there is they were like, sir, like we loved having you. Like, we hope you come back and take command of our troop. And I would just always say to them, like, I don't really know what I did. And they're like, sir, you saw us as people, man. Like, you wanted to get to know each of us. And we believe that you wouldn't issue us an order that you would not first go do yourself. And I don't know, when you're able to come with that emotional intelligence, or just not even intelligence, like awareness, I think it just speaks volumes to people. And it just is a small, easy thing to do, but it really opens up doors and it really opens up relationships.
Well, and you flip that script, right? You take that ROTC kid, you throw him to the bulldozer PSG, and you got a nightmare on your hands, right? You have pure chaos. You have a commander who is now trying to back their lieutenant, and like the killer on the officer side of things, combined, they've maybe been in the army for 15 years total, right? And then you look at the enlisted side of things, you look at it specifically a PSG. They've been there 15 years all by themselves. There's no real fight there. You know what I mean? Like, you can't argue about what the right thing to do is because that person knows, and these people can't. They can know what higher wants to get done, but everybody who's been with the unit for more than 10 years, they're gonna know how to plan a good annual training. There's no
Absolutely.
way that a lieutenant can go out and say, okay, this is what we should do for driver's training. It's
No.
like, it doesn't matter how much YouTube you watch, you know, it doesn't matter how good you are at whatever you learned. Knowing and seeing 15 years of annual trainings where they've done driver's training, that is real competence. And I think that is the emotional intelligence that you're talking about, where you know that this person actually knows, and you have the proper respect to be like, you actually know what you're doing. I don't lose rank by saying I don't know what I'm doing. You know, like that's something that we as Peace Corps volunteers are perfect at doing, is saying, I don't know what I'm doing, but I will do my best to help you get it done. And they'll love that.
And once you teach me, I won't forget that. And the next time I'm faced with this circumstance, I will have the right answer as a result. Like, I'm gonna get out of your way and learn from you, but I'm picking stuff up as we go. And the next time we come across, like, hey, we're gonna run a land navigation training with the soldiers, like, I know how that works. I can handle that. That's like the baby step as a PL because there's no weapons involved or anything. It's just dudes with compasses out there trying to find points. But like, I can do that now. And now the PSG can be like, great, I can just the PL can handle that. And it's like the next thing is like, oh, hey, I got to run the M4 qualification range. And it's like, fuck, I've never done that before. And there's 600 dudes with rifles. I hope no one shoots themselves, you know, or someone else. Like, I'm responsible for anything that takes place in this range. And the PSG is like, sir, I got you. We're going to work on this together. Well, you know how many times I've ran that M4 qualification range now? Like five. And
Dang.
it's like the PSG, he got me trained up at that first go around. And the next time it's like, hey, I know how to do this, man. Like, you got other bigger things to do. Like, go take care of business. Like, I'll take care of the range, you know? And then you just build from there.
No, they build that competence, and that is, you're so right. Like, it's the proper respect of I will learn from what you're saying, and it's not because it's not because like I don't know what I'm doing. It's because you know what to do, you know? And as soon as they hear that, man, you're off to the races, 'cause they will give you the best answers. They will be invested in your success. They will want you to get those OER bullets so that you can come back and take command, because you've given them everything that you could as a leader, you know, truly.
And it's a self-reinforcing cycle because it's like the, if you come with the right mentality as a PL, the PSG is going to want to work with you to make you better. You make him look good because he's running a platoon that's well functioning, that has, you know, a low level or a low number of like personnel issues. Like, everybody's showing up on time because they want to be there. It's a positive environment. They're not skipping drill. And it just kind of reinforces itself. You as a PL, you're continuing to learn. You're assuming more actual responsibility. You're taking more sort of proactive action on stuff because you know how to find stuff and you know how to fix problems. The PSG can spend more time actually doing PSG work. As a result, the soldiers feel like between mom and dad, they're being taken care of. And it's just all feeds back into itself. And, you know, by the time I left my PL time, it felt like, man, this is like a well-oiled machine. Like, this is,
It's great. It's
yeah.
great. It's like leaving Peace Corps. Once you like after the 2 years, when you actually know what you're supposed to be doing, you're really leaving at the point where you know what to do. And it's powerful to look back at that and think, okay, because that does translate into every job, every full-time job, every National Guard post, everything that you do from that point forward. So,
Yeah. It's very true. And it comes with perspective too, right? Like, I came out of Peace Corps and I was a lot of my immediate takeaways were very literal, right? Like, okay, economic development. You need public-private partnerships. Like, you need to encourage NGOs to, like, there needs to be like successive reports on like water infrastructure projects in this region, because I'm seeing all these NGOs come in and launch a water purification project, it fails, they leave, another NGO comes in, try to do the same exact thing, tries, fails. So you're like literally like trying to like, these are my takeaways. But the more distance you get from the experience, you realize that no, the actual takeaways and lesson learned are more about like culture, connecting friendships, building partnerships. Like, I don't know, if that groundwork isn't there, like none of the economic development, health, education, I know that stuff's possible without the trust. And
I
you
think
know,
you're right. You're right. When you're talking about the causality of emotional intelligence, like, is it causal or correlational, right? Are you learning to be emotionally intelligent during your time in Peace Corps, or does Peace Corps select for emotional intelligence? Either way, the only way to have a successful Peace Corps time, because those NGOs that kept trying to do water, they kept getting stopped at step zero, right? And they were trying to figure out step three, right? They figured that step one and two were done, and they were trying to figure out step three. You get all of step zero taken care of by the time you're done with that first year. You know who you're talking to, you know what their, you know, your key stakeholders and what their ambitions are and why they want that. And you kind of see, you know, it's kind of like the I don't think Abe Lincoln said it, but it's the Abe Lincoln quote where he, if he had to cut a tree, he would spend the, and he had 3 hours to do it, he'd spend 2 hours sharpening his axe and then 1 hour chopping the tree because that's what you have to do. You got to lay that foundational groundwork.
Oh, that's so funny to use that example too, because I mean that very much is like the TLP process, the MDMP process. Like, if you don't sit down and you get your operations order given to you from your commander, if you don't sit down and make sure you understand the commander's intent, and at least in the world of reconnaissance, it's like, what are what's the reconnaissance guidance, what's the security guidance, like what is expected out of this mission? You shouldn't be doing any mission planning. You shouldn't be going out there taking whacks at that tree. You got to move back to the basics and understand what is the actual problem here. What am I trying to solve for?
What does success look like? And so many people, they get yelled at and then they try to fix it. But they still don't know what success looks like. All they know is they got yelled at. And so that is something that Peace Corps teaches you is getting yelled at. It doesn't hurt that bad. Figuring out what needs to get done, that's the most important part. That's actually worth something.
And like Peace Corps, it's like you go make mistakes because and learn from those mistakes, and then don't make the mistake again, But it's okay to fuck up. I was gonna bring up another example too. I don't know if you've seen the movie Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
No, I haven't seen
Came
it.
out
I've heard of it.
10 years. It's kind of an interesting crossover, just like our conversation. It's about combat journalists in Iraq, Afghanistan. I forget the actual storyline, but there's an interesting parallel to this discussion because at one point in the story, these journalists are trying to, they're attached to an army unit that's in an Afghan village, and the soldiers have helped build a well in the village. And the journalists are reporting on it as like public affairs, like showcasing the help that
Winning
the
hearts and
American
minds.
winning hearts and minds, right? Well, then the storyline, the narrative continues, and they loop back to the well later on in the movie, and the well is not being used by the locals, and this lieutenant colonel sitting there, and he's like, I don't understand, these people don't want our help, like this is bullshit. Well, Tina Fey plays one of the reporters, she's a woman, right? So then she like puts on like culturally sensitive attire, and then she just goes and talks to some of the women, like, hey, just out of curiosity, why aren't you using this well? And the woman's like, well, our old well was outside the village, like 1 kilometer. And part of the reason the US military wanted to build the well in the village was so like women don't have to spend as much time during the day collecting water. Well, this local woman told the reporter, she's like, we liked having the well 1 kilometer outside the village because it gave us a break from the household duties, and all the women would go to the well to collect water, and it was a social time. It was a chance for us to like gossip and talk about, oh, my child's dealing with this issue. Like, what have you done? Now the well's inside the village. It's a 5 minute walk from me, and I have to go with a male family member to go there. I don't get the social time that I used to have. And the reporter in the movie is just like, oh man, if only they had spoken to the locals first before spending $2 million building this well, they would have realized that it wasn't needed.
Well, and this is the issue. This is the issue across all foreign aid. This is the issue across like military operations, everything. Oftentimes we're solving for the wrong problem. So often, even in a personal life, you can be trying to fill whatever need that you have, but with the wrong thing. You think that this is going to fix, whatever issue you're having in your life, and you put all of your effort into something that doesn't make a difference to what's bothering you.
No, that's very true. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. And that's what I love about Peace Corps, I think, and the military as well, is like it just makes you think about all of that. So thanks, man. It was great. It was great. Is there anything else that you wanted to share? Any other stories or anything else?
Man, I mean, lots of stories. Maybe we should do a part two on that, and we should get into some more stories. But I've appreciated this conversation. It's been great connecting with somebody who has such a similar, professional story, ridiculously similar professional story, and like kind of understands the, I don't know, just the struggle. You know what I mean?
For sure. I'm there with you, man. I'm there with you. And you're killing it, Ask anybody on LinkedIn. You're killing it.
Well, again, it doesn't show the failures, and there are a lot of those. So,
Hell yeah. No, but all the most success to you. I hope you get command time next week, man. Godspeed, you know, and
Yeah.
whatever else you're aiming for.
You too, man. I wish all the best for you. Yeah, we should definitely reconnect. I'd like to keep in touch, keep tabs,
Hell
see how
yeah.
things are going.
Of course. If people wanted to reach out, where do you want them to find you on LinkedIn? Is that the spot?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. My personal email is also stlundy7@gmail.com. So you can feel free to reach out. And yeah, I'm happy to connect with anybody that's thinking about Peace Corps, thinking about the Army, currently serving in the Peace Corps, currently serving the Army. You know, hit me up.
Hell yeah. Well, Lieutenant Lundy, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And we'll be sure to put that in the show notes. But thanks for the time.
Cool, man. Yeah, it was good talking.
Remember to be kind to yourself and treat yourself as a learner. Are you considering a career in the military but feeling overwhelmed by the ASVAB exam? Look no further than GammonAllTutors.com for the best ASVAB prep courses. Our courses are designed by experienced instructors to help you master the best sections of the ASVAB exam, including mathematics, English, and general science. We use proven teaching methods and provide extensive practice materials to ensure that you are fully prepared on test day. With GammonAllTutors.com, you'll have access to comprehensive study guides, personalized tutoring sessions, and online practice exams. Our courses are available on demand, so you can learn at your own pace and on your own schedule. Don't let the ASVAB exam hold you back from achieving your career goals. Sign up for GammonAllTutors.com ASVAB prep courses today and take the first step towards a successful military career.
Okay.